I'm Tariq Osman, and here on the BBC World Service, it's the second part of our new series, The Making of the Modern Arab World. Today, I'll be looking at the movement that swept the region in the mid-20th century, not least in Egypt and Syria. Arab nationalism, beginning in a quiet place amid the hubbub of central Cairo. I've just stepped in this extraordinary room in central Cairo. Dark wooden floors, very high ceilings with 9 glamorous chandeliers, 7 beautiful Persian rugs, and 2 huge marble columns. Today, this is the Diplomatic Club. But in 1948, this beautiful building was known as the Muhammad Ali Club, and it was right here, in this card-playing room, that Egypt's King Farouk came to enjoy himself.
In grim contrast to the picturesque burnous and headdress of Arab tradition, come the armored cars of modern warfare.
Here, as his army was fighting the soldiers of the new Israeli state, King Farouk played cards, gambled, and danced. But meanwhile, in the thick of the fighting, one young member of his army was growing ever more angry. And by the time he returned to Egypt, that man, Gamal Abdel Nasser, was set on throwing his self-indulgent king out of power, and on transforming Egypt.
What is Arab nationalism? It means Arab independence, Arab independent country.
In this series, I'm tracing the story of the modern Arab world through some of the great political visions that have shaped it, and the story of the young officer Gamal Abdel Nasser's overthrowing of Egypt's King Farouk marks the rise of the political vision that would come to dominate the Arab world in the 50s and 60s. Arab nationalism. Arab nationalism had been germinating for a long time. But the 1948 war between 6 Arab states, including Egypt and Syria, and the newly created State of Israel was a watershed moment. The creation of a Jewish state in the Middle East meant very different things to the two sides of the conflict. Professor Itamar Rabinovich of Tel Aviv University.
In the Israeli view, Zionism and the creation of Israel is a return to the ancestral homeland and, more important, normalization of Jewish existence, give the Jewish people a state, and particularly in the light of what happened in Europe in the 30s and 40s. For the Arabs, it was not just a colonial act, it was putting a bridgehead in the midst, at a very important point that separates Egypt and the African part of the Arab world from the eastern part of the Arab world.
For Gamal Abdel Nasser, this view was certainly part of his Arab nationalism. But the 1948 war with Israel also focused his attention on the deficiencies of the king's regime back in Egypt.
The story of Gamal Abdel Nasser starts in the Palestine War in 1947-1948.
Professor Fawaz Girgis of the London School of Economics.
He realized that the Egyptian government and the Egyptian monarchy, which was basically dominated by Britain, did not really invest in a nationalist army, did not create a strong army that can defend the homeland and defend other besieged Arabs like the Palestinians. He felt betrayed by the Egyptian monarchy, by the old classes, by the cronies, British colonialism.
By 1948, despite the liberal and constitutional nature of Arab politics in Egypt, Syria, and other countries, the regimes had failed to achieve the most important goal of their people at the time, independence from the European powers. They had also failed, or in most cases did not try, to reduce the shocking gap between the region's elites and the vast majority of the people. In a sense, many Arabs saw this war as a last chance for the entire Arab ruling structure to redeem itself. Professor Eugene Rogan of the University of Oxford.
I think the average Arab citizen had no doubt at all that once the states surrounding Palestine sent their armies in to liberate the country, that the Jews would be roundly beaten.
But Israel defeated the Arab armies.
That was the ceasefire call which the troops in Palestine heard this morning. It came to them by radio from Cairo.
The shock that confronted the average Arab citizen when the new state of Israel was to defeat every single army that engaged it in the field, Egypt, Transjordan, Syria, Lebanon, was something they had absolutely not been prepared for. Their leaders had promised them victory. They totally counted on their leaders to deliver. And the morning after, they were faced with the reality of masses of Palestinian refugees and a very strong Jewish state in their midst.
This defeat, which the Arabs came to call a Nakba, or the catastrophe, was the final blow. For millions of ordinary Arabs, including Gamal Abdel Nasser, the entire liberal political order was discredited. Charles Tripp of the School of African and Oriental Studies.
In some countries, the effect was very dramatic in terms of the resentment of both the population, but also more dangerously for the regimes, of the army officers involved, of the way they had been led into the war and the way the war had been conducted. So in both Egypt in particular, but also in Syria, it was the trigger of effectively military coup d'etats.
In July 1952, a group of young military men called the Free Officers, led by Gamal Abdel Nasser, ousted the king and took power. By 1954, Nasser had suppressed a rival power bloc, the Islamist Muslim Brotherhood, and was in control. Now that he held supreme power in Egypt, Nasser was determined to transform his society, and his efforts to secure the financing of his ambitions culminated in the most dramatic decision of his reign, one that he was well aware would transcend economic policy and make history and bond him with the aspirations of millions across the Arab world.
That 100-mile international shortcut to the Far East, the Suez Canal, was run by a company with Britain as its biggest shareholder.
On 26th July 1956, Nasser announced the nationalization of the Suez Canal. This sent shock waves all the way to Britain, as is clear from the tenor of the movie tone newsreel which reported Egypt's action.
Now Egypt's President Nasser has made his grand. He calls it nationalization.
It is, in fact, the greatest international waterway in the world. And what Colonel Nasser has just done is to seize it for his own end.
Crucially, from the Prime Minister Anthony Eden's viewpoint, it was a blow to British interests in controlling the most important strategic asset in the Middle East and securing the flow of oil to the West. So Eden tried to take the canal back by force in a bid to crush a man he saw as a rising demagogue of Arab nationalism who actively worked to end the British presence in the region.
Mr. Chairman, we make no apology and will never make one for the action which we and our French allies took together.
But without American backing, Britain had to retreat. Nasser had won.
Dignity was a term that was used by Nasser throughout, from 1952 to his death in 1970. It resonated deeply among Arabs, not only by talking about the Arab world, Arab culture, Arab legacy in great terms, by challenging European colonialism. 1956, the Suez Crisis, made Gamal Abdel Nasser the most powerful man in the Arab world.
After his victory against the old imperial powers over Suez, Nasser, for millions of Arabs, was the embodiment of Al-Watan Al-Akbar, the great nation of Arab nationalist dreams. What did that mean? Well, Arab nationalism was beginning to take shape, facing down the old colonial masters, building modern armies, supporting the cause of the Palestinians. But crucially, for the vast majority of Arabs, it also meant a redistribution of power, from the elites of the liberal age to the masses of poor peasants and laborers. In Egypt, Nasser wanted to transform the society. And nothing signified that transformation more than land reform.
At that time, some 10 years ago, 2,000 people owned a fifth of all the good working land in Egypt. People like the owner of this place behind me here sometimes had holdings of tens of thousands of acres.
Here is a situation where you live on the land.
Jean Shalcraft of the London School of Economics.
You have to pay all sorts of feudal dues to the pasha or the lord who controls the land. And you're not even allowed to, for example, purchase a shirt from the city because you might find one of the henchmen of the pasha comes and rips the very shirt off your back because you're getting above your social station. You didn't have control or ownership over your land and your means of production.
Well, Nasser's reform law changed all that. His holding was immediately cut from 4,000 acres to 200. In 1961, another law was passed. He now gets only 100 acres.
They offered to a significant section of the peasantry the possibility to own and control land for the first time.
Nasser's drive for social transformation went much further, from industrialization to wide-scale education to the era's grandest project, the building in Aswan of the High Dam.
But it's not just the ownership of land, it's the idea that now, if you save money, maybe your eldest son can go to the city and maybe he can get an education for the first time. And maybe, a dream, another generation down the line, perhaps he can learn a profession and one day he'll be a lawyer or an engineer. And this whole idea of upward mobility, you see, it's not just this question of social justice, which, of course, is very significant, but it's the question of people being able for the first time from the countryside to make gains. And then in Nasser's factories to get a secure job, to get social security, to get a pension.
Although she supported some of his reforms, Hiba Handoussa is critical of many of Nasser's policies.
I perceived a lot of lack of freedom in that era. I felt very frustrated because everything had to have a permission and a stamp, and so there was so much bureaucracy. You know, education was filtering through, but not fast enough. And in retrospect, I've held it very much against Nasser that a lot of the public expenditure was allocated in an extremely poor distribution, including education. It was very, very discriminative in favor of the middle class and at the expense of the really poor.
To his supporters, here was an ordinary man from southern Egypt who had risen to control the largest Arab country, who was governing for ordinary people. But how did Nasser's Arab nationalism, social projects and all, seen from the perspective of other Arab states? Charles Tripp.
I think what people read into Gamal Abdel Nasser when they looked at him across the Arab world was, on the one hand, seeing him as the epitome of the person who had stood up to imperialism, the old imperial power being humiliated, driven out of Egypt. So people may not have known the details, but they saw a defeat for Britain and a defeat for France. And in 56, they saw it as a defeat for Israel to some extent as well. So in many ways, he was an extraordinarily powerful figure. And when you think about what was going on in 56, it was still, Algeria was still much under French rule. The Iraqis were still under the Hashemite monarchy. So there was a sense in which he held a kind of inspiration for people who wanted to free themselves from colonial rule, but also from feudal rule within. Because there was this notion, again, that he had been a leading revolutionary against the monarchy, had created a republic. So if you looked at the young Yemeni officers, for instance, they saw him as the ideal for helping them to overthrow Imam Yahya, the Yemeni monarchy in Yemen as well. And of course, therefore, the monarchies of the Arabian Peninsula, Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and elsewhere, and of course Iraq at the time, saw him as a huge threat because he was the person who was not only attacking their allies, the British and anti-imperial to some extent against the Americans, but he was also the one who had actually made a point of saying that republican socialism should be the pattern of Arab development for the future. And that wasn't exactly going to go down well in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere.
In Syria, however, there was a lot of support for Arab nationalism. Syria was the birthplace of the other main strand of Arab nationalism, the Ba'ath Party. The Ba'athists objected to the colonial borders imposed by Britain and France decades earlier. The party, which was co-founded by a Christian, the writer Michel Aflaq, was strictly secular. And like Nasser, the Ba'athists were socialists. But Ba'athism had a harder edge than Nasserism, as Fawaz Girgiz explains.
The Ba'ath Party, in many ways, subscribes to this whole idea that Arab nationalism is really an enclosed ideology, an ideology that has a particular exclusive character, unlike the ideas of Gamal Abdel Nasser, that more inclusive ideas of Arab nationalism.
The Ba'ath Party found itself promoting its Arab nationalist ideas in a Syria which by the 1950s was establishing itself as a democracy. The writer Rana Qabbani.
I remember that the democracy existed in Syria and that anybody could say anything they liked and that there were cafes where people sat and argued politics and that there were many, many political parties and that there were many newspapers.
But severe inequality weakened the foundations of this nascent democracy. Charles Tripp argues that political maneuvering also played a role in its coming demise.
It was a very socially divided and unequal society in terms of class, in terms of the rich and the poor. And as a result, socialist parties, but more particularly communist parties, became very active. The fear of communism was much greater than the reality of communism in Syria, but it loomed large in the imagination both of the old social classes who felt they were all going to be dispossessed, but also, of course, by the up-and-coming Ba'athist Socialist Party, which feared that the Communist Party was actually taking their constituency and taking their ideology, their programs. And the solution to this, it seemed to them in the 1950s, was to petition Gamal Abdel Nasser.
Fatefully, in 1958, a group of Syrian military officers, including Ba'athists, took the extraordinary step of flying to Cairo and asking Nasser to accept a union between Egypt and Syria.
When Nasser first received the delegation, he was totally unprepared. He had used the language of Arab nationalism as a rallying point, but had never really intended for the literal merger of Arab states. But since this was now what was being offered him, he would agree to make union with Syria, but only if Syria were to come entirely under Egypt's rule.
And so the United Arab Republic was born. The Arab nationalist dream seemed to be coming to life, as celebrated in this song by Muhammad Abdul Wahab, the great nation, Al-Watan Al-Akbar. One Syrian woman we spoke to was a child in Aleppo at the time and remembers the rapture that greeted Nasser's arrival.
We believed in Nasser and we all were in the road just calling Nasser, Nasser. We loved him. We were very much excited to see him from distance. We were children. So I think people were hoping that Nasser will do something for the Arab nation.
Much of the Arab nation was overjoyed. For a moment, it seemed that Iraq, maybe even Jordan and Lebanon, might join the United Arab Republic. But in the end, none of this happened. And for many in Syria, the dream of Nasser's Arab nationalism was very different from the reality that ensued after the union.
It was the Syrian military that had to dissolve itself. It was the Syrian political parties that had to dissolve themselves. It was the Syrian political institutions that had to be dissolved. And curiously, all the people in positions of power had strong Egyptian accents. So it was a realization that they had made themselves into a province of Egypt.
It was like a dream. Everybody wanted it. And we grew with it, actually, my generation. We grew, and the love of this idea was put by Abdel Nasser, by Nasser. It was put in our hearts since we were children, and we believed in it. But then with the years, you feel it's not achievable. It's a joke. It's like somebody put a dream, and it's not going to happen.
After only 3 years, Syria seceded from the United Arab Republic. This kind of Arab nationalism had not worked. But the experience of the union between Egypt and Syria had a crucial impact on the Arab nationalists of the Ba'ath Party. Charles Tripp.
under the United Arab Republic, the demand by Gamal Abdel Nasser and the Egyptian authorities that both the Ba'ath and the Syrian army should be dissolved was deeply resented by many. But the people who were in a position to do something about it were the Ba'athist military officers, and they refused to dissolve. Secretly, they kept together. So Hafez Assad, Salah Jadid, and the whole group of them maintained a conspiratorial organization. By contrast, the civilian Ba'athists were out in the open, chased around, hopeless.
Eventually, the officers would push aside civilian Arab nationalists like Michel Aflaq. And that militaristic form of Ba'athism would come to dominate Syria and Iraq for decades. Makram Khoury Makhoul, a former independent communication advisor to the Syrian ambassador in London, argues that the rise of the military in Syria was normal in the Arab world.
The reality of most Arab states, and of course apart from monarchies with petrodollar or religious authority, is that the army is revealed as the main decision maker and spearheads the ruling elite, because they are as well educated. So from its ranks, the military produces and introduces political leaders. And this was the case, or this has been the case. Take Egypt, Algeria, Tunisia, Libya, Yemen. So Syria is not the only country to be introduced as a country which has been led by a military elite.
Meanwhile, the collapse of the United Arab Republic took its toll on Nasser's standing. But in Iraq and Lebanon, Yemen and Algeria, a barrage of coups and revolutions in the 1960s strengthened the Nasserite brand of Arab nationalism. Like many Arab nationalists, Nasser placed the Palestinian cause at the center of his rhetoric. But his attitude towards Israel went beyond that. He saw Israel as a strategic threat to the dream of Arab unity. And the assessment was relatively similar from Israel's side, where many of its leaders considered Nasser and his project a strategic peril. And then in 1967, war broke out again between Israel and Egypt, Syria, and Jordan. And Israel won decisively. Arab nationalism continued to be the ruling ideology in several Arab countries in the next few decades. But it was never the same. The dream was gone. As for the millions who believed in Nasser, he was no longer the infallible hero, no longer the Messiah.
And the gun carriage, the black gun carriage, horse-drawn, the coffin draped in the flag of the United Arab Republic.
Within 3 years, Nasser was dead. Arab nationalism lost not just its most powerful leader, but its symbol.
The coffin is absolutely hemmed in now by troops and police.
In death, millions mourned the dream that he represented, but the legacy of the leader of Arab nationalism was already diminished.
You can only hear the crowd shouting now, shouting their lamentations, shouting, Nasser is good, Nasser is good.
But for many, Nasser's era was never a dream. The Egyptian novelist Ahdaf Suwayf and Samia Jaheen, the daughter of the leading poet who wrote many songs praising Arab nationalism and Nasser, told me about those who had lost their political freedoms under Nasser's rule.
Salah Jaheen admired Nasser very much, but at the same time he also criticized him. He has a very famous poem he wrote called the Baramhat Song. He wrote that when his friends were jailed. And he was so sad because he learned from a close friend that every time his name was on one of those lists of the people who were supposed to be detained, Nasser himself would cross out his name out of those lists. So he felt like if Nasser didn't love him that much, he would have been one of those people being tortured in the prisons of Nasser.
I was a child growing up in Nasser's time. He was really charismatic. And of course, he was doing things that were about dignity and independence. And of course, you could see that he was on the side of the poor. And so, of course, I really, really admired him, even loved him, really. I learned things later, of course, to do with the absence of democracy, to do with the autocracy of a military man. It didn't actually make me respect or care for him any less, but I grew to see him more as a tragic hero, a man who was great in many, many ways and who had one tragic fault which brought about his downfall, which was ultimately that he didn't trust the people enough. They loved him and they trusted him, and he didn't trust them back enough.
The Arab world found itself inheriting a deeply problematic model of leadership. Many Arab leaders tried to model themselves on Nasser. Qaddafi in Libya, Saddam Hussein in Iraq, and Syrian Ba'athist Hafez al-Assad. But what these men took from Nasser was less the bond with the ordinary people, more the militaristic regime and the persona of the strong man. So Nasser's legacy was a resurgence of Arab pride, a redistribution of wealth, an ambitious industrialization program, and a dramatic boost in education and social services that expanded the middle classes. But it was also a militaristic and at times brutal model of government, which could use the rhetoric of Arab nationalism to justify itself. With the decline of Arab nationalism, though, what would rise in its place? In next week's program, we'll find out how, in the 1970s, the movement Nasser thought he had crushed, Islamism, came back. You've been listening to The Making of the Modern Arab World, presented by me, Tariq Osman, and produced by Phil Tinline. The BBC.